ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What role does collective action play in cultural leadership? From the wharves of Woolloomooloo to the cattle stations of Wave Hill to the cotton fields of Wee Waa, trade unions have played a significant role in the advancement of Aboriginal civil rights. Distilling the skills and sentiment of solidarity, already so deeply embedded in how mob build community. Yama Malia, and welcome to Away, the home of Indigenous arts and culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer. Today, Thomas Mayo, Gilar Michael Anderson, and Richard Franklin explore the history and culture of collective and assertive action in the fight for Aboriginal civil rights. It'll take you through instances of racial and colonial violence, both historical and contemporary, so listener discretion is advised. But in these discussions, you'll hear why we need to ensure our hard-won rights don't roll backwards as time marches forwards. Plus, for Word Up, you'll head to Tasmania with Daisy Allen, where she'll share a little Puluwakani. So stay with me here on Away.
Thanks, Adam, and that is it for this evening's bulletin. But before we go,
I want to let you know the 7pm news will look a little different tomorrow night.
Because ABC staff will be on strike.
Because my colleagues and I will be on strike.
Because ABC staff will be on strike.
Because my colleagues and I will be on strike.
We're asking ABC management to deliver secure, safe and sustainable jobs.
So we can deliver the news and content you deserve. I'll see you Thursday.
Recently, my colleagues and I took part in protected industrial action. Basically, we went on strike for 24 hours. I've been a member of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance for a few years. And on a really practical level, being part of my union doesn't touch my life all that much. I pay my dues, I get a discount on tickets at some theatre companies, and I can enter the country's most prestigious award for journalism for free. But every now and then, being a union member takes on a bigger meaning. And lately, I've been thinking a lot about collective action as a cultural principle. Because honestly, unity, solidarity, and collectivism, it's how we've won some of our biggest fights for civil rights. And detangling that advancement of Aboriginal civil rights from union solidarity, it's pretty tough.
These Aboriginal stockmen are on strike. They walked off the job over a month ago. Their wives, children and relatives went with them.
When 200 or so Gurindji, Ngariman, Milanara, Walpuri and Mudbura mob walked off the job at Wave Hill Cattle Station. They weren't just calling for land rights, although that was obviously a big part of it. They were striking because they weren't being paid a fair and equitable wage, one that was equal to the non-Indigenous workers on the station. The strike lasted 8 years, with various unions around the country providing both practical and fundraising support. And while this example looms the largest in our collective memory, it's by no means the only example. Warramai man Charles Frederick Maynard, better known simply as Fred Maynard, was a wharf labourer in Sydney and an active member of the Waterside Workers' Federation of Australia from around 1911. His time as a wharfie and his involvement in the union saw Fred develop his public speaking skills. And in the early 1920s, he led public protests against the assault on Aboriginal rights, speaking at local meetings and lobbying the Sydney and regional press. In 1924, he launched the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, AAPA. In his inaugural address to the organisation, Fred asserted mob aim to work out our own destiny, adding that,
Our people have not had the courage to stand together in the past, but now we are united and are determined to work for the preservation of all those interests which are near and dear to us.
Meanwhile, Pearl Gibbs, who was also heavily involved in the AAPA and was the first Aboriginal woman to ever speak on Australian radio, also cut her political teeth on industrial action. During the Great Depression, Pearl moved to Nowra to pick peas. While there, she helped organise protests against the management of the Aboriginal Reserve and supported the 1933 pea pickers' strike.
There's a long history of solidarity between unions and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
That's Thomas Mayo. He's a Kararag Kalkagal Erombul Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander man who lives on Larrakia country. Thomas is also an author and the Assistant National Secretary of the Maritime Union of Australia. Earlier this year, Thomas was in the Torres Strait to celebrate the 90th anniversary of the 1936 maritime strike.
Now, very few Australians have heard about this strike, and you know, as a Torres Strait Islander, it was, it's a particularly proud moment to celebrate this history. That before a lot of the strikes that we know about was this maritime strike in the Torres Strait, where Torres Strait Islanders that were working on luggers, that they had actually paid for themselves. They had actually had loans around the end of the 19th century that they paid off by working on these vessels. When the White Australia policy reached the Torres Strait, these vessels were confiscated from them, and the men were forced to work on them for rations, basically. And so after, I think, just over a decade, they organised a strike across the Torres Strait. And they organised it by, you know, across this, you know, expanse of water and tiny islands and the difficulties to communicate in those days. They coordinated this strike that led to the Torres Strait Islanders having a voice. So from that, there was a negotiation that were very much like a union negotiation. There were island councils established, and there was some autonomy in the Torres Strait that still exists today compared to the mainland.
Thomas says Torres Strait Islanders who sailed on merchant ships learnt about industrial action from their unionised peers.
We already knew how to stick together, but then some of those tactics combined with our cultural knowledge, I think, led to the very effective strike that they had. And then soon after that, in 1941, the same Torres Strait Islanders, some of the same men, went on strike, as in they were the Torres Strait Battalion. So they were in the Defence Force, and they went on strike because they weren't getting equal wages there either. And they made some improvement. They still didn't get the same as the white fellas they were working with and dying next to, sadly.
These are fights we've had to take on again and again. In 1946, around 800 Aboriginal pastoral workers across the Pilbara walked off their station in defiance of the Aborigines Act of 1905. Their one simple demand was to be guaranteed a minimum wage of 30 shillings a week. In 1957, seven Aboriginal men led the Palm Island strike. They wrote a petition that they gave to the superintendent, and in response, the police on the island conducted a dawn raid, arresting the men at gunpoint. Then, of course, in 1966, was the Wavehill walk-off. Thomas says in most of these instances, non-Indigenous union members provided effective action in solidarity.
And those organisations, those unions, deciding before before other organisations had started to take that stance of solidarity, the union movement was there and refused to, wharfies and seafarers refused to export cargoes in solidarity, which put massive pressure on the pastoral stations that the Aboriginal workers had walked off. These are really important, I think, parts of our history. And I think, and especially when I speak with elders around the place, they remember the importance of the union movement to their struggles. You know, the Noonkanbah dispute as well, another one in the Kimberley, protecting a sacred site there. You know, unions were, the land rights struggle as well. Unions helped fund, you know, we took the hat around, the tarpaulin musters, they called it back then, because everyone would chip in a bit of coin onto you know, a tarpaulin and gather it up and just an important part of our history.
That's not to say there's never been friction or disappointment. One of the first points of policy when Australia became a federation in 1901 was to restrict non-white immigration. At the time, it wasn't just mob being paid significantly less than white male workers. People of colour were also being underpaid. And some companies even stooped to the practice of blackbirding. Basically, it's the kidnapping or fraudulent recruitment of people from the Pacific Islands, Torres Strait Islands, and in some cases, Aboriginal people on the mainland. They'd be brought here and forced to work on sugar plantations or cotton farms or to dive for pearls. And because these people weren't being paid, unions got concerned that white fellas were being denied jobs. Rather than fighting for equitable rights, they threw their energy behind supporting the Immigration Restriction Act, the law that underpinned the White Australia policy. While they'd eventually abandon the now-defunct policy, unions are driven by their membership base. So when cotton chippers in Western New South Wales went on strike in 1973, some Aboriginal workers considered starting their own union just for mob. Here's the late Paul Coe speaking to ABC at the time.
It's the first time it's ever done that Aboriginal people themselves had initiated this type of economic action, that they're prepared to form their own union because they believe the other unions are not concerned about their welfare and are not doing anything on their behalf.
Gillar Michael Anderson led that strike in Wee War. He'd returned home to Gadooga after establishing the tent embassy the previous year. And while living on his country that summer, he travelled to Wee War to take on the back-breaking work of chipping cotton. Gillar remembers walking down the street just after New Year's Day.
And an elderly lady, she's passed on now, and I hope the family forgive me for mentioning her name, but her name should be known, Auntie Doreen Inch from Collarindabri. And she walked up to me in the street, and she pulled me up and she said, "Son, you belong to them Black Power mob in Sydney, eh?" I said, "Yeah, well, I was part of it, yes. They're broken up now." And she said, "Well, you fellas did some good things. Can you help us to get higher wages here working in the cotton?" And I said, "Well, it'll take a job, but we'll have to do it white fella way." And I said, "That means we all got to stop work." And I said, "We got 1,500 people plus about 500, 600 white fellas working in this industry." And I said, "We'll have to pull all them together because this won't work if everybody don't work together."
That Arnie spread the word. And the next Saturday, people gathered at the local pub to hear about the plan.
The publican, who I knew, he'd never had so many black fellas come in his pub in all his life, but he only had a small beer garden. And he realised you're not going to get all the black fellas in that beer garden, plus some of the white fellas who was coming as well. And he came out and he asked what was going on. He said, and then he realised that it was about politics and a fight. And he said, "Michael, get out of my pub. Get out of here. I don't want to be part of this." And so I went and stood in the middle of the street, right in front of the pub.
There's actually a picture of Gillar standing on the street addressing a crowd of a couple of hundred people. He remembers telling them if they were going to strike, they'd need to do it right.
And I said, "Save all your money, because if you're going to go on strike, you're going to need it."
When the morning of the strike rolled around, Gillar was shocked to see a semi-trailer mounted with stereos and microphones parked where the picket line would be.
So I walked across and they were from the Newcastle Trades and Labour Council. And they paid for this whole setup. And then about 11 o'clock, people started gathering. And And there would have been about 1,500 to 2,000 people in that park, and that included white fellows. And I told them what we would need to do if we were to succeed in this. And at the end of it, a couple of white fellows came up, or there was about six, came up to me and said, we're cotton chippers. We work out in a different area. Are we able to join this strike? And I said, mate, if you're in it, well, then that's good if you're prepared to go on strike. And they said, yes, we are. And so they became part of the team.
I don't want to oversimplify the work that went on in WeWar, or really any of the strikes that have been mentioned. These kinds of sustained, assertive collective actions are arduous. They involve the hard work of so many people. And standing up could be seriously dangerous. About a week into the cotton chippers' strike, a couple of Gillard's aunties started to get worried.
Auntie Isabel and Auntie Edna agreed that I should go up and stay in the house that Auntie Isabel and Uncle Joe Flick had in WeWar. So I went up and we camped on the floor up there in their house. And a couple of nights after we'd moved, about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, there was this parade of cars that came uptown into the street where my auntie lived, and people were crying and were very concerned, and there was a whole lot of people came. And they were all singing out to Auntie Isabel and Uncle Joe. I walked out onto the landing and said, what's wrong? And then everyone cried with joy, basically, because then they told me that two vehicles, wagons, had driven up to the tent where I was camped and fired a number of volleys into the tent by a shotgun. Fortunately, I wasn't there. And so my aunties had this idea and felt that it was unsafe for me to be there. And I thank goodness for their wisdoms and their concerns. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here to be able to tell you this story.
Regardless of any scare tactics, Paul Coe and the Aboriginal Legal Service got the case into arbitration court in Sydney.
And we succeeded. Let's put it that way. We succeeded in that the court decided that we were to be granted a 25 cent an hour increase in wages. Now, when you're working 12 hours and 14 hours a day, that adds a significant amount of money to your paycheck. And this is 1973 we're talking about. And so there were, that 25 cents multiplied by 10 to 14 hours gave you a lot of buying power. And that was very successful. In fact, when I got back, the people were very appreciative of the efforts. It's important to understand, though, it wasn't just me, it was a people, and it was a people's movement. And the fact that Auntie Doreen Hinch came to me and asked me to do something made it possible. I would have just gone along chipping and doing my thing, partying like everyone else, earning some money. But that old woman had the forethought of being able to sort of take it further. And she saw an opportunity, and she grabbed that opportunity to sort of say, oh, put the onus on me to say, you know how to do things. Can you do it? And, of course, from little things, big things grow, they say.
When Gillard looks back at this time and the influence trade unions have played in our fight for civil rights, he can't help but think of Ewan man Charles Chicka Dixon.
If we go back to when we started, when we started the Black Power movement, one of the things that was always there was that Chicka Dixon, who became a wonderful mentor to us, he's now passed as well. Without him, the Black Power movement, I don't think would have stuck together as it did for those number of years. I think it was about 3-4 years. He was the glue. He was the wise one. He was the elder. And as he used to tell us, I got educated in the best universities in Australia. And we asked him which universities were they. He said Long Bay, Grafton, and Goulburn, jails. And so we took everything that he said. Was there was a lot of wisdom because he was guiding us very well, and he understood the politics as well, and he had the background of understanding of how Western society operates. And that was helpful for us because we were all, you know, between the ages of 17 and 20, 21. So we were all young, basically. And the core of that group was about eight people. And the trade unions, he worked on the wharves, which was a wonderful thing because the wharfies in Sydney were basically the backbone to a lot of stuff that we do. And they would do fundraisers on payday and raise the money for us to do things that we needed to do, attend other conferences or organise people or organise something around what it was that we were putting together, like the demonstrations, etc., and assisting us getting placards and being able to write things. So we needed the money. It wasn't much, but it was enough to make it all happen for us. The other trade union that was really, really on side was the Builders Labourers Federation. A lot of stuff that we got as well through them was courtesy of people like Jack Mundy and Bobby Pringle, who were the key players in the Builders Labourers Federation at that time. They were people who fought for civil rights and civil liberties in Australia, and they protected certain areas in Sydney that they felt that should be protected, and they won. So we were pretty much supported by two pretty powerful units, and we can also acknowledge their impacts worried the Australian government to the extent that John Howard went after them and caused investigations into those two key organisations, and they changed the law to effectively control them.
The Howard government's changes to the Workplace Relations Act of 1996 saw significant restrictions to the kinds of industrial action workers can take. Here's Thomas Mayo again.
I've been, a union member for over 30 years now, I think it is, and I've been a union delegate for a lot of my years on the wharf and then a union official since 2010. So that's 16 years now. There's one thing that I've learnt. You cannot take these rights for granted, or your conditions of employment, your job security. You can't take any of it for granted because it's always under attack. And I think a lot of workers don't realise that that's what unions are always doing as well. They're not just supporting individual members now and again with a dispute. You know, if something happens, you know, like they're in a disciplinary action or something like that. But they are constantly defending against governments taking away those rights by diminishing those employment standards that we all take for granted. They're constantly defending universal healthcare, especially when a coalition, you know, a conservative government gets in, because they don't like that. That's not, you know, part of their policy thinking. They think everybody should just fend for themselves instead of looking after each other. And employers associations, because the bosses have unions, right? The employers have unions. They all talk about how they can make, you know, things cheaper for them so they can make more profit. But unions are in the background always defending these things, in the Fair Work Commission, in the court, to the High Court if we need to. All of that takes lots of money. And that money doesn't just, you know, fall out of the sky. It comes from all of us chipping in through our union membership.
Thomas reckons in some sectors, the employers and sometimes even governments already hold disproportionate power over employees, making the decision to take any kind of action incredibly intimidating.
You know, when we listen to our fellow workers and we're having these discussions, I think that's important to acknowledge. You know, employers make threats in those times, you know, and they might not be standover bullying type threats that are obvious, but you know, subtle things that make you worry about job security or, the continuation of having enough work in the place. You know, they might say, oh, the clients are going to leave us and, you know, or these programs will be shut down, you know, thinking about, you know, from a media and entertainment perspective. So those sorts of things go on during bargaining. You know, that's all part of the tactics. And so it's scary. But in my experience, you can beat around the bush for a very long time and get nowhere as workers if you're not organised and you don't have a strong density of membership and you're not willing to go on strike. But you get a better result sooner if you have that density, if you're sticking together and you walk off together.
And look, collective, assertive action, it's part of a healthy democracy.
The ability for people to be heard against those efforts to silence us or to the efforts to ensure that nobody can hear people that are struggling or people that have something important to say or for a national discussion to happen about an important topic, those are things that that diminish our democracies. And we see democracies on a cliff's edge all around the world right now, and some are going over that cliff's edge. And Australia is on that cliff's edge as well, I think. You know, we've seen those efforts escalated to silence people that have a legitimate concern and that want to be heard about, you know, important things like staying out of war and, you know, and wanting peace. These abhorrent things that we're seeing around the world, people want to be heard about that. When people are legitimately concerned and fighting for peace and saying, you know, this is something that, you know, our country needs to take a stronger stand on, then they should have the right to get out on the streets and to protest without police brutality. I think, you know, as mob, we feel, you know, every blow against a peaceful protester, every punch in the ribs, because we know too well what that's like throughout our history. So it's an important time for this discussion, for Australians to steel themselves against, you know, the efforts to silence us and those influences from outside as well. It's not just within Australia, but we see on social media, you know, the efforts, some inside, you know, Pauline Hanson has a divisive brand of politics. So we have to get, I think we have to be prepared to make our voices heard. And the best way to do that is to get out on the streets sometimes. And that's an important part of our democracy. And we shouldn't shy away from it, even when we're being bullied.
I want to circle back around to the idea of cultural practice. You've heard how Mob have collaborated with trade unions to develop our strategies for collective action. Of course, solidarity isn't confined to protests and protected action. Gundich Maraman, Richard Franklin, is an accomplished creative and cultural leader. And 35 years ago, he was a field officer to the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody.
I think it's horrific to think that there's been 600 deaths since the end of the commission and that we're still incarcerated at this in horrendous, disgusting way, and that the incarceration is seen as punishment as opposed to rehabilitation. I see the pain in people and the anger and frustration. I see the fear. I see that people are looking for a way to navigate through this. Many people are calling out for justice. Many people are calling out for an answer to the grief. I sit with the memories sometimes. Sometimes I try and find a quiet spot, or if I tell the stories too many times, it can knock you about. I think being a custodian of songs about deaths in custody and films, it's hard to protect them in the Western system. You've got to make decisions about, is it better to give someone else control of those stories and custodianship? Is it better to keep guarding them? How do you contain the grief of a nation, of many Aboriginal and Islander nations who've lost someone in custody? When I was a young man, hearing those stories, you'd be screaming inside thinking, why can't these people in traffic see and know what I know? And if they did see and know what I know about deaths in custody, would they do anything? Do they have the power to do anything? My reflections are complex. and they're not consciously daily, but they sit in me. And they're stories that I'll carry until I don't exist anymore. And I've got secrets from the dead that I'll carry until I meet them in the next world. That's what we get, isn't it, when we do those jobs?
So whether you know Richard for his policy and academic work, his work as a playwright, a filmmaker, a musician, or through Jawed Warung Elders Corporation, community is at the heart of Richard's work.
Wherever I've travelled around the world, there's inequalities. And for our mob, we were invisible for a long time, and our voice was, if it wasn't for very brave and strong people, we would have gone unnoticed. My job hasn't been about being the voice, it's being a voice of one of many, but mainly facilitating the voice of our mob and the issues that we face. Bart Willoughby said in this tremendous song, Message for Young and Old, that we see the world's problems but no one sees ours. And it's so true. And it used to be, going back decades, it was even more true, and decades again. I mean, we have fantastic warriors, and they're warriors, they're political warriors, they're activist warriors, they're art warriors, they're people who paint, who write poetry, do music, make films. We have great strategists, diplomats, lawyers, doctors, not just in the Western Eurocentric cultural shape, but in our shape. We have people who navigate complex cultural loads, sometimes a funeral a week. Yet we still have, because we're not heard, we're not listened to, we still have, you know, a suicide rate that's amongst our young, that's probably the highest in the world, an horrific incarceration rate, disgusting chronic illnesses. We have homeless, yet on a proportionate basis, we're an amazing people. We still achieve, we still contribute. The importance of this cannot be understated. We have to enable our voice to be heard. We have to continue to stand up. To do that, most of all, we have to be united. So we're pretty much invisible, seen and portrayed as a problem people, but we're really a people with a problem.
When you think back to what put you on this pathway, what was the moment or who were the people that really opened your eyes to the importance of the need for us to work as a collective and to work together?
I think Steve Biko, who now deceased, he was an amazing activist out of South Africa. And he died of a cerebral brain hemorrhage, was dumped at a hospital, beaten up. He said the most potent weapon of the oppressors are the minds of the oppressed. And when we cast our eyes around not just First Nation Australia, but every oppressed peoples in the world, we see that there's large division, that there's so many issues that for us to link arms and march together, it can be quite difficult. And we attack each other in the most horrendous ways. We make false claims, we put people down, we point the finger. And it destroys people's lives and careers. And there's no real defence against it because people are in pain. We call it lateral violence, and lateral violence comes from trauma. And we have six invisible traumas, seven really, to the Western Eurocentric health system. And these traumas come about simply because of invasion / colonisation. They wouldn't exist otherwise. Transgenerational trauma, not just from stolen generation, but transgenerational trauma from losing our cultural shape, our law, our legal system, our health system, losing our societal structures, losing our land and waters, our trade systems, our languages, discrimination trauma from being labelled, and that can be as small as being followed in a shop, which does still happen, to being racially abused. In fact, there was a study done in 2011 which said that 97% of First Nation people had been abused at least 8 times in any given year. And if you were abused 12 times or more, racially abused, that is, it was likely that you would suffer from psychological distress. We have another one, navigating the dominant culture, the bureaucracies, the ever-changing strategies, the trying to rent a house, be accepted. That's a trauma in itself. We have another one, which is lateral violence trauma, which is the trauma of hostilities between ourselves or being labelled. We have another, which is cultural loads. So cultural loads are our complex lives, having to go to so many funerals in a year, having to be the First Nation encyclopedia wherever you're working, the constant gravitas of pressures in your family. And then there's vicarious trauma, constantly having to tell and retell the same story. So every day becomes a cross-cultural awareness, even sometimes within our cross-cultural relationships. And the final one, and it's not necessarily the final, but it's a culminating trauma when all of these things meet at once and intersect, and we have this compounding, culminating trauma. And I don't think there's a First Nation person I know that doesn't carry the loads of these types of traumas, that doesn't scream inside in great pain, that doesn't go out of their way to make non-First Nation people comfortable in a conversation, that doesn't feel alienated.
Richard says, in order for mob to work together to gain and maintain civil rights, we've often had to take one step forward and 2 steps back.
We live in a really complex situation, and we're immersed in it. So sometimes we miss the obvious. And we cannot win the right to be to equity and justice without people who are brave enough to step across the cultural abyss between us. We need to revisit the nursery version of history that's portrayed and challenge the dangers of that single narrative so that we can actually grapple with contemporary happenings. And we need to recognise that many of our non-First Nation brothers and sisters have been indoctrinated or socially engineered to think and act a certain way. And this is really problematic because it's embedded within in them, even with the concept of terra nullius, land of empty people. We had to unravel that legal fiction in the courts, and we had to fight tooth and nail. Now, if we have to do it in a legislative way, we also have to do it to the attitude that not only created that legislation, but that wanted it to live. So when quite often when I talk to people, some people, they don't know the basics of our culture, like what is sorry business. They don't know that the purpose of a smoking ceremony is to welcome people to that particular bit of country or that particular bit of land or waters. They don't know that it's about cleansing. They don't know that we had an entire social order, villages and towns of 3,000 people down this way. They're not aware. They've been sold a myth for so long. So it's about how do we bring them up to speed so we can link arms and hang out together. And then when they're being attacked at their dinner table by a racially challenged uncle or auntie or friend or partner even, how do we give them the right tools to defend themselves? How do we assimilate these non-Aboriginal people into our culture, our world, our way? And then once we've done that, how do we empower them? And then how do we collectively create a vision for unity for the future? I think that's what it's about. Well, there's a massive division that's been created long before they were born. How do we bring them to us? How do we hold them? How do we teach them to listen and hear, to see and feel? How do we teach them to have that the pathway to a quiet spirit is by uniting our vision? So there's a thing I wrote called The Five, and I want to encourage all our mob to think about this. Have kind eyes so that you see others with kindness and you also see yourself with kindness. Have a gentle tongue so that you speak kindly of others and you hear the way people speak kindly of you. Have good ears so you listen and hear those good stories, even the ones you tell yourself or that have been told about you. Have wise hands so you don't hurt others and you don't hurt yourself and you build good things. And always, always strive for a quiet spirit. Just like gentle water, gentle wind, that quiet spirit, you'll never get it completely, but you'll get it for moments here and there. And remember, much love and be deadly. MLBD.
That was Richard Franklin. You also heard from Thomas Mayo and Gilla Michael Anderson. Special thanks to Dominic Zara for reading Fred Maynard's speech. You're listening to Away, the home of Indigenous arts and culture on Radio National. And Richard Franklin truly is the gift that keeps on giving. He brought his guitar along for our yarn. So this is the Gunditjmara man with his song, Tears Can Talk. It comes from his time working on the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which Richard says was the hardest job he's ever done.
Did you know that tears can talk? Oh, can you hear? Oh, can you hear what they say? Do you think you know the answer? From the games, from the games, from the games that they play. And I can hear them whisper, all their sorrows. And I can hear them calling, calling out my name. Well, I can hear them calling out my name. Were you close? That final curtain. Oh, will you shut? Oh, will you shut that door of life? And if you do, will you be sorry? Ah, for the things, ah, for the things no longer in your life. And I can hear them whisper, all their sorrows. And I can hear them calling, calling out my name. I can hear them calling out my name. I can hear them whispering my name.
That was Tears Can Talk by Richard Frankland. He released a new album just last year, Discovering Lirpan Mara. It was co-written with Mark Holden. I'm Rudy Bremer, with you here on Radio National, and it's time now for Word Up. This week, I want to introduce you to Daisy Allen. She's a language worker in Luchuita, Tasmania, and your language legend throughout April. To kick things off, Daisy is sharing the Paluakani name for a river reed used in weaving.
Pukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walter.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Dianye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Reipiri.
Ngaraguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka. Wakaniniana.
Wardadoia.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Diepa.
Murupuk.
Ya Pulingina, Meladina Palawa, Luchuita, Mina, Daisy Allen. Hello everybody, and welcome from Luchuita, Tasmania. My name's Daisy Allen, and I am sharing today Paluakani, which is the language of Tasmanian Aborigines. So I am a Paluakani language worker at the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre, based in Launceston on Cunnamulla River Tamar. I have been a Paluakani language worker now, teaching Paluakani to the Aboriginal community across Luchuita, Tasmania, probably since 2007 when I first started working at the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre. So I've been in the Paluakani language program for close to 20 years. It's a very rewarding role. Nutipa, nutipa. So that's, nutipa means river reed. So nutipa is important culturally. Palawa women use nutipa to make baskets, and our old people would make beautiful baskets, and we still continue that cultural practice to today. Our elders and women in the community share their knowledge with young people and youth, and so we will go out on country and gather and collect nutipa and then get around and string it, weave it into baskets, just as our old people did back then. My name's Daisy Allen. I'm speaking Paluakani, the language of Tasmanian Aborigines, and I'll be with you again next week. Wulika, goodbye.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Daisy Allen sharing a little of her language, Paluakani. She'll be our language legend all month here on Radio National. You can catch the full series of Word Up, including all our language legends, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's the show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on Gadigal Country by Ruby Ritchie and me, Rudy Bremer. Technical production by Mickey Grossman. We'll have more Indigenous arts and culture for you next week on Radio National, or check out a full suite of stories on ABC Listen. You'll find us there along with Word Up and our titter program Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Barrett. This week, Larissa will pay tribute to the indelible impact of the late Aunty Rhoda Roberts, before taking a look at a new peak body working with community-controlled organisations to address family, domestic and sexual violence against Indigenous women and girls. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.